I think we can start. Good afternoon, everybody. I'm very happy to start our working meeting today, which seems to be unusual from two perspectives. I think it's the first hybrid meeting connecting people sitting here in the room in Bischofsvilla and virtual presence. And as I know, it's also the first joint meeting of the Zukunftskolleg and of the Center of Cultural Inquiry of the University of Constance. And as a member of these both institutions and research communities, I'm very happy, and it's really a big pleasure for me to welcome here in Bischofsvilla in presence two researchers from the University of Manchester, Vera Dolitz and Stephen Hutchins, both professors of the University of Manchester and my mentors. And the visit to Constance was made possible by support of the Zukunftskolleg and of the mentorship program of the Zukunftskolleg. And I want to say thank you very much for this support and funding of this meeting. It is our second meeting, and 2 years ago I started to work at your wonderful project, Reframing Russia from Global Media Sphere, from Cold War to Informational War. And had the possibility to launch a new working
group.
And now I'm working at the project further and make research to Russian Today German, especially the coverage of COVID-19 pandemic. And I look especially on the issues of visuality, populist communicative logics, and Soviet iconic heritage on Russia Today German. But I think the issue of disinformation, which will be addressed in the paper today, is relevant not only for my current research, but also for the media environment around the world. So my duty belongs to introduce our speakers, which I will do with big pleasure. Stephen Hutchins is professor of Russian studies at the University of Manchester. He is author and co-author of 6 monographs on aspects of Russian media and culture. And he is a fellow of the UK's Academy of Social Sciences and former president of the British Association for Slavonic and East European Studies. Vera Dolitz is Sir William Mather Professor of Russian Studies at the University of Manchester. Her most recent books are Nation, Ethnicity and Race on Russian Television, Mediating Post-Soviet Difference, together with Stephen Hutchins, and Russia's Own Orient, The Politics of Identity and Oriental Studies in the Late Imperial and Early Soviet Periods. In 2017, she was a co-editor of the UK's National Centre for Language-Based East European Area Studies, and she's a fellow of the UK's Academy of Social Sciences. Before we will open the floor for our speakers, I would like to address very shortly the organizational details of this event. The talk will be, I think, about 40, 45 minutes. And then we will open the discussion. And as usual, please raise your hand or write or put in chat with your question. Don't forget to unmute and mute again back when you have finished. And the last thing I have to say before we will start the talk is that the talk will be recorded, but not a discussion. Please don't hesitate to make questions. It will be not recorded. Thank you very much to Roland Fischer who make this recording possible. And now I'm very glad to open to give the word to our both speakers.
Thank you, Asha, for that generous introduction. And it's very nice to be here in Constance again. I made the journey here. As you were saying, it's an unusual situation, and to the Examples or reasons that you gave, I can add a couple more. It's also unusual because I'm not sure the same is true of the other, but for me, I think it's the first time I've spoken to an audience since, I don't know, since before the pandemic, albeit a virtual audience. So we're not too rusty. And the other reason it's slightly unusual is that what we're going to present to you today is based at least in part on research that we haven't yet carried out, but rather on a future research agenda. So what we're going to present to you is the basis of a large grant proposal that we're working on. So any comments, questions, sessions that we have will be even more valuable than they normally are in these situations. But that said, the proposal is informed by some preliminary research that we've carried out. So as well as a short pilot project. So the talk is not purely speculative. Whilst working on the previous project that Masha mentioned, she said that centered on the role of Russian international broadcaster RT in the so-called information war with the West. We became rather kind of struck and frustrated by the loose and inconsistent use of terms that were themselves we found problematic. And we found that this was a phenomenon that applied to politicians, to journalists, but also to researchers. And one of those key terms was disinformation. And along with a whole array of equally poorly defined and differentiated affiliated terms, including misinformation, trolling, malinformation, hyperpartisan propaganda, astroturfing, and I could continue. Those terms are now, despite being poorly defined and differentiated, they are ubiquitous in public discourse, and certainly they reflect the fact that disinformation is indeed one of the biggest challenges facing democratic societies. And as we well know, COVID-19 most recently, and before that, the Russiagate scandal after the 2016 American election in the US have offered recent confirmations of the depth of that problem. And that problem has, not surprisingly, generated a response. That has generated multiple responses in the form of counter-disinformation units, fact-checking organizations, monitoring organizations, online literacy initiatives. That's certainly one of the big focuses of attention in the UK. Legislative restraints, activities of intelligence services countering disinformation. So it is a multi-pronged and very significant response that does reflect genuine concerns about the capacity of certain authoritarian states, including Russia, to exploit weaknesses in our societies. But the extent of these operations also point to what one very well-respected American journalist, Joseph Bernstein, has recently quite provocatively termed a big disinfo knowledge industry. And of course, he's drawing an analogy with Big Pharma. And the way he portrays it is that this knowledge industry is self-replicating and self-serving, not least because funding for these initiatives often depends on identifying ever more material, ever more instances of different disinformation, and ever more strategies to counter it.
The phenomenon itself is accepted as a given, and there's very little reflection on the assumption behind the term or the way the monitoring is carried out. And yet, together, these multiple responses have formed a powerful alliance that includes technology companies, NGOs, state agencies, and universities. And so, of course, Vera and I are very well aware of the fact that by conducting research into this phenomenon, she and I, we together are ourselves in a way contributing to this industry, and that's something we have to be well aware of. So there is a contradiction, a tension, a paradox in this very project. That's just I won't dwell on this. Just based on a 30-second trawl on Google, I found five or six different examples of various counter disinformation units, fact-checking organizations, and including Atlantic Council, which is connected to NATO, EU versus Disinfo, which we'll talk about more, that's connected to the EU, and then EU Disinfo Lab, which is a NGO, and there are many, many, many more of very, very different provenance. So what this knowledge industry, as Bernstein calls it, fails to do is, as I said, to interrogate the terms and the concepts behind the practices that they so readily identify and the discourses that generate these terms and concepts. And by the same token, given that these discourses, like all discourses, are context specific, they really fail to take account of the differences in the ways these terms are used and understood in different linguistic and cultural environments and at different points in history. And finally, and in a way, most importantly, they don't allow for the ways in which not only the meanings of disinformation narratives, but the very status of those narratives as disinformation changes as they travel across linguistic, cultural, and historical borders, how they're calibrated for new audiences by the producers of disinformation, for new audiences who in turn reinterpret them according to their own local cultural codes and norms, and nor do they recognize that the very tools of counter-disinformation themselves enter this discursive dynamic and contribute to it as it shifts across these boundaries. So in a nutshell, that phenomenon is what it is we're hoping to get to the bottom of. So what we're going to do is to try to really offer a new way of approaching disinformation, one that focuses on how discourses about disinformation change across time and across lingual, cultural, and geopolitical divides, the trajectories by which narratives that are identified as disinformation travel, the context, the discursive context in which those narratives are embedded, and the relationship between the historical legacies of these discourses, the conceptual differences in the terms that they use, and the variations in the counter-disinformation principles that are advanced to combat them. So it's a large and ambitious agenda, but to our surprise, it's one that really has not been tackled before. Questions have not been asked in the way that we're posing, which is worrying, but it's also surprising. The problem at the root of the way that disinformation is currently talked about, I think, is the way that it tends to be treated as the negation of something called information. So we have information, which is based on true facts, and we have disinformation, which is the negation of true facts. Now, that doesn't mean for one moment that we, as researchers, don't accept that some narratives do indeed have a sounder basis in facts than others. That would be foolish to deny that for a moment. But as soon as you begin to try to talk about and make sense of those narratives, you enter the realm of meaning rather than hard data. And in fact, you know, the very term narrative, when you think about it, is based on the idea of reshaping reality to generate meaning from it. And so in that sense, the combination, the collocation, disinformation, narrative is a sort of contradiction in terms. as humanities scholars, and we are, you know, very sort of clear and proud of the fact that we operate in the humanities, we study meanings rather than dead, mute facts and data. And meanings are generated, or tend to be generated, precisely at the borders between and across cultures, individual subjects, time periods, and discourses. And here we take our lead from Bakhtin's theory of dialogism, but also from Uri Lochman's theory of meaning as translation is the central trope of his theory of semiotics. And you know, as both recognize, to accuse someone of disinformation, to allege disinformation in any context, is a communicative act with meaning. It's a dialogic exchange across the border between two subjects or two cultures, and an exchange that's socioculturally and usually politically situated. So that's the basic framework for our approach, and what we're going to do and have already to some extent begun doing is having a look at some of the data available through national language corpora, about which we'll talk shortly, focusing on English, Russian, and German. But in fact, we're going to look at a total of six languages in full. And so we have already begun doing some preliminary research relating to the changing usages and meanings of the concept of disinformation across history and across these lingual, cultural, and political divides. And then what we are proposing to do is have already done tentatively some work around or some specific case studies where we're going to offer in-depth qualitative analysis of narratives designated as disinformation, contemporary narratives, by the EU's primary counter-disinformation unit, referred to earlier, EU versus Disinfo. So we've done a little bits and pieces of that work already, but nothing systematic or in depth. And if we're lucky enough to get funding for the larger project, then we're going to supplement those methods by applying Begriffsgeschichte, I should not be able to read that. So history of concepts to get at the diachronic and synchronic analysis of how these terms are used, both within specific periods and across periods, and also comparing the use of conceptually related terms, but always and only placing those sources in the socio-political context of their time. And then we're going to, as I explained, provide in-depth discourse analysis of certain key texts. So going back to this article by Joseph Bernstein, the failure to take account of the discursive perspective that we're proposing is it's implicitly at the heart of his critique of big disinfo. And the article, if you care to read it, it is well worth a read. It's provocative and quite controversial, but it's well written and it's well worth a read. It's in Harper's Magazine. And in a way, he goes further than us, and he attributes the creation of this industry to a series of political crises in the West generally, and in particular in the US, and claims that this industry has as much to do with these crises as it does with increased activity by authoritarian states like Russia and China. And so you see that reflected in the first quote there. And it is certainly the case that much of what we call disinformation, misinformation, has its origins not so much in the activities of authoritarian states, but in online groups at the alienated peripheries of Western societies, even if those activities are certainly appropriated and exploited by authoritarian regimes. And he too, in his article, he notes this same proliferation of very poorly distinguished overlapping notions. And he rightly, I think, perceives that this accumulation, agglomeration of poorly defined terms, in a sense, it has the effect of abstracting the concepts from their context of usage and creating this impression of a vast, universal, undifferentiated phenomenon that's deprived of precision and meaningful value. But this homogenization effect does serve a purpose. It serves a purpose of allowing a clear and unbreachable boundary to be drawn between those who practice disinformation on the one hand, and those who are outside it and whose task it is to identify it and call it out. And in that sense, disinformation is always, in one way or another, connected to an othering function. And it is that othering function that we think is common to and essential to an understanding of disinformation discourses. And Vera is going to provide a little bit more detail on how that has tended to work historically. Next section of the presentation.
So very briefly, just to say after Steve's introduction of our thinking around our new project, is basically to say that it will target disinformation as historically and socio-politically contingent communicative act between players. Based antagonistic players. And the project is conceived as consisting of the study of the usages of the term disinformation and other terms related to the broader concept of the manipulation of information from the early 20th century, the First World War, to the present. And then our specific case study of the travel of specific narratives identified by this the main EU disinformation tracker, EU versus disinfra, as pieces of disinformation, will study their travel across different linguistic boundaries and social political boundaries, and will take into account this historical legacies, will identify in the first part of the project in account in our analysis of this specific contemporary case studies. And so it will be constant interaction between research, historical research, largely with a methodology adapted to our own use of Bygrinsky shift, and I'm sure everyone here sort of knows this very impressive study initiated by Kozelek and his group. But so we'll have a kind of
back and forth dialogue between history and the present day. Basically, the very history of the term disinformation is embedded in the antagonistic and sort of interaction involving othering and the conflicts which played out across geopolitical and linguistic divides. And there is a very common kind of mythology about, around the emergence of the term disinformation. And according to this received wisdom, which is very widely repeated, not only in contemporary media coverage of the issue related to disinformation and politicians, particularly in the Anglophone world, I don't know about kind of German media, but also in academic literature, is that the very term disinformation was coined by the Soviets, and some even say specifically by Stalin, about those kind of claims, many, and that the Soviet term disinformatsiya was then translated into English. And that the term was coined deliberately to confuse the origins and then present the origins of the term and by implication of the practice as foreign. And again, the received wisdom is that it's the term was deliberately kind of coined by the Soviets to imitate a French term. Actually, even a quick kind of analysis of the data available in various national corpora will tell one that this is not the case, this etymology is wrong, and that the term is actually seen to be first point in English in the late 19th century and used already since the 1880s by American media to accuse each other of disinformation. And then the hazard corpus of the terms and words used by MPs, deputies of the British Parliament, shows that this word started to be used by British politicians accusing each other of disinformation, at least from 1901. That's the first recording. Just to, as a kind of, in a way, for Russianists, it's an interesting footnote. The Soviets indeed used the word disinformation in an unusual way, because we already see from the examples I gave that it's a term of othering. It's somebody else is accused of disinformation. Let's say that particular kind of positive image of self is created by this act, a negative image of the other. But the Soviets used the term disinformation to describe their own practice. And that was a kind of a new usage. And in 1923, the Politburo of the Communist Party, or the Bolshevik Party, as it was then called, issued a decree on the establishment of Disinformed Bureau, Disinformation Bureau, confuse the Western world as to the state of the Soviet economy, so present it as in a better state than it was, and present the Red Army as a more combat ready than it was in 1923. But here again, even the fact that the term disinformation is used, and why it's disinformatsiya rather than disinformatsiya, kind of one needs to look into it, but it seems to me that the person actually that we can identify as a person from the GPU, the Soviet in the secret police, who came up with the whole idea. And this was the person very closely connected with the German communists, and it's likely to be sort of an influence of German language rather than French on the Soviet spelling, the Russian spelling of the word. Now, the fact that the term, and already you see here this interplay between translation, transliteration, and geopolitical divide, just two small points around this. First is that even though this word disinformatia was used first as a kind of self-description, unusually, by the Soviets, clearly they still represented themselves, and you can see it even in this Politburo resolution, as the possessor of a higher truth. And they need this disinformation because the West wants to subvert this higher truth in their attempt to create a more just society. But secondly, there is a confusion around, which is very common, again, conceptual historians point out that sometimes researchers tend to confuse the term with the practice, and the term and practice are two different things. And the fact that the Soviets coined the term in this particular context doesn't mean that the practice, which is of manipulation of information by governments for political end, was actually invented by Soviets or the Russians. In fact, the practice of setting up a disinformation, a kind of governmental unit specifically to produce forgeries to confuse the enemy, is the practice originating in the First World War, clearly with a US Committee for Public Information set up by Woodrow Wilson. But again, it's interesting difference between democracy and authoritarian regime. Woodrow Wilson uses the euphemistic name for the committee, while the Soviets are using this brutal kind of crude name, but it's because in a democratic context, you need to sell in a kind of positive way what you're doing, and there are no restraints on the communist government in terms of what methods they use. Then if you look at the kind of range of national corpora, and in addition to this Hansa, the corpus of the language used in the UK Parliament, the corpus of American historical English, we also use the corpus of contemporary American English, the British National Corpus, and also the Russian National Corpus. And there is also the digital dictionary of the German language, which is a major German language corpus. And we can again discuss it. Some people in the audience kind of are familiar with the begriffs Geschichte research. There are issues around using corpora within Begriffsgeschichte sort of framework, and we are aware of the limitation of the what corpora can tell us, and so we can discuss it further. But if we look across this several national corpora, we'll still can identify certain trends. And I should say that the corpora we use, they all can do similar kind of searches, and they can present information according to the same criteria. So we're talking about comparable data. And if you preliminary analysis we've done reveal very interesting trends that mostly starting from the turn of the 20th century, up to the present, with the exceptions of the two world wars, mostly the use of the word disinformation, you can get through this corpora the data arranged according to decades. The use is in relation to specific national context. So it's different media, different politicians within the same society accuse each other of disinformation. And outside the two wars, there were only two specific periods when suddenly this accusation of disinformation is focused on the other, abroad and outside the national borders. And in both cases, this outside other is either the Soviet Union or Russia. And one example of this disinformation as the term related to an outside force, which is Soviet Union, is the early 1980s. And another period is between 2016 and 2019. And there are sort of very striking similarities between both periods, because we both start with very polarizing votes within Anglophone societies. So 1980, the decade starts with a vote for Margaret Thatcher's government in 1979, and then Ronald Reagan is elected in 1980, and 2016 is, of course, the votes for Trump and Brexit. These, as I said, very polarizing votes within Britain and America. And in the 1980s, the kind of sudden, there is overall a sudden rise of the usages of the word disinformation, let's say in British Parliament, but also in the American media, according to this corpora. And it's very clear to me that this usage is a reaction, and its sources we looked at describe that, to the publication of two books by defectors from the Soviet bloc, who come up for the first time with this claim that the Soviets invented the practice and the term. And so the corpora, both of Historical American English and Hansa, show that within these sources that they look at, 50% of all references to disinformation is KGB disinformation or Soviet disinformation. And then you have very, in a way, similar situation from 2016, when again Hansa and this is the corpus of contemporary American English, again, almost half of the usages is Russian disinformation. But then you have quite sudden drops in accusations of the foreign other, and reversal to accusation of domestic opposition or opposition accusing the government. And in 1985, from 1985, we have a sudden drop. And we can, of course, relate it to Gorbachev's perestroika, improving the relationship between the West and the Soviet Union. And but also it's very clear that disinformation itself, or the manipulation of information by different forces, is not seen as a major threat to democracy, because this is the point before World Wide Web, before social media, and established elites do not feel that they're losing control over information flows. But in 2016, of course, there is this, the issue is exacerbated by the fear that the Western elites are losing this control over information flows. In 2016, we have a clear reason for the sudden emergence of accusations against Russia. It's Russia's well-documented interference in 2016 elections in the United States. There's no doubt that the Russians did interfere. There is only can be debate as to whether this interference had an impact. And then it's less well documented whether the Russians interfered in Brexit referendum, but there were a lot of accusations. And even before that, in 2014, Russia starts a massive disinformation campaign against Ukraine. So you can say, okay, these accusations of Russia, of course, clearly directed to Russia's actual behavior. But it's actually not necessarily the case, because Russia's most apparently effective disinformation campaign, and that is the one around the origins of HIV virus. The peak of this campaign was between 1985 and 1988. So it is Gorbachev's period. However, relatively little concern with the Soviet activity around this campaign, and say likely to reflect improving relations, and also it's not seen as such a major threat at the time. And then, interesting, between 1985 until the basically 2015, 2016, again, we have this long period of the use of the term very widely, but into politicians and the media internally accuse each other. And the Russian corpus shows that the Russian usage mirrors, sometimes in an inverted way, the Western uses, and also reflect international relations as well as domestic politics. So we have a sudden increase of Russian publications accusing, Soviet publications accusing the West of disinformation in response to these books by the Soviet defectors. Then from the late Gorbachev's period and throughout the 1990s, actually, most of the discussion of disinformation is about internal disinformation and criticism of KGB disinformation. And then from 2014, 2015, and 2016, it's again a return to Russia accusing the West of disinformation. So we have this kind of mirroring technique. In German, we have slide showing the kind of various uses of this narrative about AIDS in different political contexts and in different linguistic and national contexts, sometimes stimulated by the Soviet Union and sometimes kind of by various internal actors in those states independently. And the term disinformation seemed to be used much less in the German context. And even this German language corpus shows much lesser usages of the term disinformation or falsche information or fail information. So this terminology is kind of less prevalent. Then what does it mean for kind of today's travel, the journeys of the narratives of, around disinformation? And we looked at two case studies so far, and one is around the term Russophobia, which is very widely used in the Russian media today. Articles which claim Western Russophobia are almost always included in the database of Russian disinformation, which disinformation tracker funded by the European Union has created and is updating on a regular basis. And what we see from the information in this database that what is designated as disinformation in fact ranges very widely from clearly the articles which are deceptive, for instance, rejecting what seemed to many to be very solid evidence of the Kremlin's involvement or the Kremlin's or the Russian culpability in this poisoning of the Russian defector, double agent, British Russian double agent Skripal in the town of Salisbury in Britain in 2018. So here you can say, yes, the Russophobia is used to produce a narrative where seem to be sort of factual kind of faultness with it. Two, the articles which just claim that Western politicians and Western media have in general too negative a perception or image of Russia. So it's a polemical, it's not factual, it's polemical, but it's also included in this database. And here it seems to us that we're dealing with vastly different types of narrative. While the question arises, which of these, or both, I think both, why, need policy response? So basically, should governments fund activities which prevent polemical or partisan coverage? And then if yes, where we stop? Again, this translingual dynamic here is interesting because we looked at RT Deutsch, their website, because again, our project suggests that RT Deutsch has one of the worst reporting practices of the all RT services. And we noticed that you can do searches. In contrast to RT English, for instance, or RT Russian, very few RT Deutsch, or basically no RT Deutsch reports, used the word Russophobie or Russlandfeindliche Haltung was the equivalence. There is virtually no usage. However, in the key words with which you can search this site, and these keywords are identified by RT Deutsch itself, it's their searching engine, Russophobie is a term, and it gives articles which do not use this term. And again, there could be an explanation which relates to specific kind of contexts and histories of interaction. The term Russophobia emerges in the interaction between the Anglophone world and Great Britain and Russia in the 19th century in the context of the Crimean War and the Great Game in Central Asia. And so that is used in their kind of intercultural communication, but not so much in German intercultural communication. So it's one of our case studies, and now Stephen will present another one related to COVID, and then we'll conclude questions.
Yes, so I will I'll talk about two other sources. The slides actually represent three, but I think in the interest of time, I'll just talk shortly about two. I think one of the points we're trying to make is that ultimately the problem with poorly conceived, non-reflexive, careless approaches to counter disinformation is that at their worst, they even themselves constitute a form of disinformation. And so the source I'm going to refer to here is an example or an illustration of how disinformation and counter disinformation do or can form part of this single dynamic. So one of the narratives listed in the EU versus disinfo database disinformation was the narrative that I'm familiar to all of you now, this pernicious COVID narrative that the virus is a Western-produced biological weapon. You're all familiar with that narrative. And indeed, it was aired extensively in certain areas, corners of Russian language media, though rather, as Vera was describing in terms of the sort of the AIDS disinformation, in fact, it merged the intersection of the of activities of both internal and external actors. So that narrative was promoted by US Trump-supporting deep state conspiracists, with whom certainly Russophone extremists collaborated, and there's a form of translingual co-production of these narratives. And that tends to be somewhat lost on the US's disinfo unit. But it did indeed track one example of this pernicious narrative, in fact, to the website of Svobodnaya Pressa, which is a terrible website. It's an extreme nationalist website, but it's far from friendly to the Kremlin. It very often goes much, much further than the Kremlin and accuses the Kremlin of weakness. Moreover, that this source, which does sort of play with and present this notion of COVID as a British weapon, a British-created weapon. Ultimately, if you read the article carefully, and the lesson is, it's no good just looking at titles of sources, you have to read them. Ultimately, it concludes that the this notion of a British biological weapon emerged from Western conspiracy sites. And the author actually concedes, perhaps reluctantly, that coronavirus origin is probably non-human, as we know to be the case. So the article is terrible. It's highly tendentious, biased, prejudiced, extreme. But to list it as pro-Kremlin disinformation is it just not accurate. So there's an example of this narrative as promoted by a rather shady conspiratorial US-based site called United World International. So that's where you can find examples of the origins of this biological weapons narrative, COVID as biological weapon. And then the article in question identified within the database, yes, if you go by the title, it does indeed seem to be
bona fide disinformation. Coronavirus, najdion patient, который доказывает британский хер. But if you read the article, I mean, it's not a very pleasant article to read. If you look at the conclusion that this journalist draws, then rather sort of tamely and sort of pathetically, he reaches the same conclusion as the one that we're familiar with from mainstream discourse. Коронавирус все-таки создан природой. Конкретные мутации коронавируса летучих мышей SARS-like. And that's something different. Now, if you look at the way it's presented in the database, summary, coronavirus is a biological weapon developed by the British. Fact. Disproof, it's a conspiracy theory. This is a programming narrative about the coronavirus and the Anglo-Saxons. So, you know, in a sense, to test the audience, which of the two sides there is disinformation? I think you could probably make a case that possibly both of them represent a form of disinformation, but there is no getting away from the fact that the counter-disinformation unit is itself contributing to this dynamic in a very, very unproductive and unhelpful way. I will think I skip this one in the interest of time. What it's, well, they're all interesting. In accounting for the sort of different linguistic and cultural contexts that producers of disinformation target, you really do need to allow for the subtleties of tone, the role of modality, ironic, sarcastic, and as Vera was saying, polemics. Not only sort of changes the status, disinformation status of narrative, but it can also completely change the meaning. You know, irony, as we know, can completely transform the meaning of the semantic, of a word. And of course, there's a related issue that has to do with the divergent conventions relating to different journalistic genres, and a news report, a simple news report, makes a completely different kind of truth claim to an opinion piece. We barely need to say this, and yet EU versus disinfo consistently fails to make this distinction. It's all disinformation. And you can see why it might be in its interest to do so, because very helpfully it boosts the volume of pro-Kremlin disinformation being churned out on a daily basis. So in short, the communicative purpose of a source is can't just relate it solely to the semantics of the words. And mistakes in this area, once again, make it much easier for counter-disinformation rhetoric to be used and appropriated by the producers of disinformation, because these terms lose their value, they acquire a level of vagueness and ambiguity that equips them precisely for that purpose. So this last source that we're going to comment on, claim, again, it's in the COVID context, it accused, so this database accused a Russophone outlet of claiming that COVID-19 was designed to kill elderly Italians. The source, and to be fair to this unit, it does at least present you with the sources on which it reached its conclusions, which makes it sort of very convenient for researchers. And when we looked at the source, it was targeted Latvians, and of course Latvians are exposed to mainstream European media. What you can persuade a Latvian of is not the same as what you can persuade someone in the Russian provinces of. And it was clearly ridiculing conspiracy theories rather than promoting them.
Now, it's interesting that, that Russia's RT's French language output has absorbed much of the mainstream anti-conspiracy rhetoric that we're familiar with, and then it redeploys it, as we'll see in another source, in which RT manages to denounce France's leading bookseller for promoting COVID conspiracies. So there's the representation of the Latvian source in question on the EU versus Disinfo site, that Sputnik's conspiracy theories about coronavirus invented in Latvia, targets yellow vests, helps Gretchen, and so on. But if you look at the if you look at the source itself, it doesn't take long for you to realize that that the article is poking fun. Coronavirus is a real life. Почему в Европе коронавирус начался в Италии? Потому что в этой стране, как и в остальных странах старой Европы, слишком много пенсионеров, получающих большие пенсии. It's very, very clear that it's actually not even subtle sarcasm. It's actually very crude and poorly conceived sarcasm, but misconceived and misrepresented in a way that, as I say, only contributes to the dynamic, which is, you know, why RT can very easily get away with now importing and using and exploiting the rhetoric of disinformation, but applying it to here to a French context. So I think probably we should wind up and try and conclude. So we began by trying to point out that the terminology around disinformation is loose and vague and undifferentiated, and thereby serves to unify a single democratic self and distinguish it from a equally homogenized, malintentioned, malicious, disinforming other, and that can apply within societies and between them. Because it does have, as an accusatory discourse, it does have this othering function, positing a undifferentiated generator of the uniformly toxic content, with these multiple conflations and overlapping and poorly distinguished concepts: disinformation, misinformation, malinformation, propaganda, astroturfing, etc. And that, of course, does prove highly convenient to this multi-pronged counter-disinformation industry, in whose interest it is to maximally inflate the sheer volume of toxic content. But ultimately, failing to make these critical distinctions of terminology, of dialogic and communicative contexts in which disinformation is produced and consumed, of changes in meaning of the concept over time and across cultures, and of the relationships between counter disinformation and disinformation discourses, as these last couple of examples shows, it in fact plays into the hands of the very actors we're striving to restrain. Authoritarian states like Russia and China and others willingly take advantage by inserting themselves into this dynamic and exploiting the terminology for their own ends. And therefore, it's not only an intellectually important and valuable task, but it is of huge practical and political value to disentangle these conflations, to re-identify these borders, temporal, linguistic, and cultural, and to retrace the steps carefully of disinformation's hidden journey across them, and to treat the whole phenomenon not as the simple negation of universal factual truth, but as the product of a complex, context-specific, and profoundly dialogic set of discourses. And that it is what we're hoping to do, or to scratch the surface of in our new project. And the concluding slide, I thought I was going to offer a prize for anyone who can guess what that is, but You probably don't need me to tell you that that is RT's own counter disinformation tool, fake check. So I think on that we should conclude.
Thank you very much for this very inspiring talk, bringing together some different issues on disinformation, and from a linguistic point of view, from a historical point of view, from political and sociological point of view. Thank you very much. And I think we have to change the places.
Yes. Yeah.